This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The former chair of the Federal Elections Commission published an op-ed for Wired magazine last weekend suggesting that the integrity of 2020's election is in the hands of Facebook and Twitter. If that weren't enough to make you nervous about your feeds, maybe you caught the Netflix documentary The Social Dilemma recently. It traces the speed and degree to which we've all become commodities to big tech, our screen time sold to the highest bidder on platforms that are influencing how we perceive the world.
If technology creates mass chaos, loneliness, more polarization, more election hacking, more inability to focus on the real issues, we're toast.
As the stakes rise, we wanted to talk to Cliff Lampe, a professor of information at the University of Michigan School of Information. He's got thoughts on how we're navigating our social media environment right now. Cliff Lampe, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
How many times this year have you thought about disconnecting?
Probably every 5 minutes. and I did disconnect actually for a week earlier this summer. So it's a good way of cleansing the palate.
Yeah. How'd that go for you?
It didn't go very well. It turns out a lot of my life has been interconnected with social media. And so I came back fairly quickly.
Yeah. Anne Revell's take is that there's some existential threats right now to the American people's trust in the vote. Also, added dangers that misinformation will continue to lead to violence in the American street, and that both of these facts are because of bad information shared via Facebook and Twitter. Do you think she's overstating the case?
No, I think that there are a lot of problems going on in social media right now. Disinformation and misinformation are a huge part of the platforms. And there's a bunch of things that could be done, both legally and technically, but they're very difficult. So it's a really thorny, hard problem to solve.
What do you see as our strongest tools to fight disinformation in the short term?
In the short term, unfortunately, it probably is up to the platforms to do something. The Election Integrity Roadmap is a group that have a bunch of recommendations for what we can do with social media. So they have a whole wide set of things, some of which I think are reasonable and some of which are unlikely. On the reasonable side, pointing to new tools that the platforms are doing, like identifying misinformation or showing alternative viewpoints to a post. Another is to show kind of a history of different groups and if they change names or if they're connected to other groups. Less likely for the platforms are things like turning off the algorithms, which is a really powerful recommendation, but very unlikely for the platforms.
I mean, that undercuts the monetization of just about every, if not every, company that is a social media platform today, correct?
That's correct, right? All of the platforms make their money basically from, you know, harvesting attention, what Shoshana Zuboff calls the surveillance capitalism. So it's basically the commodification of people's attention and changing their behaviors in order to make profit.
I wonder, what should we think about when we consider how many of us just check in on social media in a rather cursory way? If you're the kind of person who regularly does deep dives on news and issues, I think, at least maybe we'd like to think, that we're less susceptible to disinformation via social media, or at least that we might, you know, take an extra step and try to verify where information is coming from. But I mean, all of us at least spend a little time every day checking in, at least in a cursory way. Is there a way to fight this that acknowledges how much of our time on social media is just clicking and moving on?
Yeah, there is. I think one of the things to do is self-reflection. So one of the things I always note for myself is when I feel emotional about a story or about a piece of information, that's usually somebody trying to manipulate my emotions for their own ends. So one, I always check in, how am I feeling about a piece of information that I see, and what's the motivation of that person for sharing it? So being self-reflective and thinking about what reactions are you having to the things that you're seeing is probably the very first step for us to do something about this.
Which do you see as being more powerful in having an effect on the social sphere, consumer activity or regulation?
That's a very good question. I think consumer activity in the short run is going to be much more powerful. In the long run, I would love to see some regulation of these effects, but that's a very hard sell in our current regulatory environment.
Yeah, the United States has always had a pretty complex relationship with regulation when you look at agencies like the FDA or the EPA. What are some of the challenges to getting an effective regulatory grip over social media with the current environment?
Yeah, they're good challenges, primarily for social media, as opposed to something like the FDA. Our biggest challenge is the First Amendment. And I don't mean to say the First Amendment is a challenge, but it's a core principle of American rights and something we should take very carefully and very seriously. When you're talking about regulating social media, you're often talking about regulating the ability of people to speak freely and to share information. So we always need to balance that regulation of social media with those core essential First Amendment rights that we have.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I mean, we've seen at least a little bit more active conversation about this going on just among users. If whether or not there's a change in Washington at the presidential level next year, do you see maybe the federal government or Congress getting more serious about this?
I think they will in a few ways. You've seen some conversations about ways to regulate some of the social media companies that aren't going to impinge individual free speech or liberty. I think you see a lot of conversation about if we don't regulate it, then what we're basically doing is leaving all of those speech rights up to the social media companies themselves, who are not a regulatory body and to whom we don't have any ability to have redress. So I think you start to see those conversations on both sides of the aisle in Congress lately. And so it'd be interesting to see how this unfolds over the next couple of years.
A cynic would say that there really isn't as much reason for a party in power to consider a change in regulation of social media. Do you think that that's oversimplifying things?
Probably a little bit, only because I think we're seeing a whole lot of effects outside of even the partisan landscape. So conspiracy theories and violence are rising across social media platforms, radicalization and formation of extremist groups. So even outside of kind of pushing an election one way or the other, I think we see a lot of potentially negative effects coming out of social media that I hope any party would hope to curtail.
A lot of us know people who have dropped off of social media. Do you think that that has happened in a way that gives some of the big internet titans any pause to think about the way that they're doing things? Or are these movements just so small that it doesn't really make any difference in their business models?
Sadly, I think it's the latter, especially given that most of the growth for most of the social media companies isn't in the United States at this point. So having a few people in the United States drop off of social media platform, and typically when people are dropping off, they're dropping off one or another. They're typically staying with some type of social media in their lives, just picking which one they want to be on. So far, I haven't seen that being a critical mass enough to have any effect on policy at the companies.
What about some of the regulatory efforts that have been taken in Europe? I mean, these steps are not gigantic when you look at how they've been applied. But do you think that's gotten the attention of companies like Facebook and Google?
Absolutely. And in fact, most of the companies have been very supportive of the regulations in Europe. A lot of these companies have been begging for more regulation because they can't necessarily manage this on their own and don't want to be held responsible for managing it on their own. So I think a lot of the companies, from what they've said publicly, would love to see more regulation in this space and have pointed to Europe as an example for that.
Tell us what you want us to do. Save right. us from our own business model.
Or at least make it so that we have cover if we want to do something, right? So if we do have to do something, you know, cover us so we're not solely responsible for making these unpopular decisions.
You know, I hear sometimes from people that say, I'd like to unplug. I really would. It drives me nuts. But I kind of have to be on social media for work. And it's certainly the case that every company, every brand has to have a social media presence to be taken seriously in almost every field right now. To what extent do you think the corporate environment is driving the longevity of our social media platforms?
I don't think it's that much. Definitely that's a part of it, in that for a lot of people, their work is interconnected with social media. That's still probably a small amount of the workforce in total. When my students and I discuss whether social media is good for us or bad for us, one of the things we always come back to is the bad things are flashy and showy, and the good things are mundane and happen every day and happen so regularly, we don't often notice them. So I think when we look at the good versus the bad in social media, it's easy to overlook the good. And people are fairly rational. They wouldn't be coming back to social media if it weren't having some good effects for them. But the bad can be so flashy and such an event that's what we pay attention to. So I think part of why we keep coming back to social media is that there's a lot of reason to be there.
You know, the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, pointed out that part of what contributed to the problem and continues to do so today is the incredibly narrow range of voices running the show at some of the larger platforms. And I think that's meant in terms of the actual diversity in the room, the number of women, the number of people of color who are involved, and just the diversity of thought and diversity of attitudes toward what the end game of a product should be. How serious do you think Silicon Valley is about changing that?
Over the past few years, they've gotten a lot more serious. I know a lot of companies have invested in research teams that are now going across the globe to learn more about users' experiences in different parts of the world. So it's something that they have come to in the fairly recent past. Are they all the way there yet in terms of incorporating those voices, especially at kind of an executive decision-making level? Probably not. But that's one of the biases of The Social Dilemma as a movie, is that they're looking at a particular period of time for these social media companies and the effects of that time. I'm not sure that they're kind of looking at where Silicon Valley is right now. Not to apologize for Silicon Valley, but I do think they're aware of the problem more so, even if they're not fully grappling with it.
Do you use the word inextricable when you talk about how social media is intertwined with our lives these days?
I wouldn't use inextricable. I would say important, right? I don't think it's inextricable. I think you can leave social media if it really is bothering you. And for a certain number of people, it can be pathological. So those people should protect themselves and do what they need to do. For a lot of us, it does have a lot of benefits in our lives and helps us to connect, especially in a pandemic world where it's hard to connect necessarily with people like we used to.
Yeah,
we do see a lot of people connecting through social media and getting a lot of social support through those channels. So for me, a lot of it depends on how you use social media. One of the most common findings in my field is passive consumption usually is associated with more negative effects, but active consumption, i.e. reaching out to friends, communicating, being a good person and talking to people in a civil way, all can have more positive effects for people.
You know, one of my summer reads was Ron Chernow's A Biography of Alexander Hamilton. Not that I got through it because it's a 900-page book, but I gave it a go. And I was really interested reading about the press at the dawn of the United States. And when we think about the ways we've communicated over that time, or even the way we communicated through media at the turn of the last century, one of the golden ages of newspapers. There were huge economic disparities. There were lots of small voices, small newspapers with agendas. And, you know, sometimes a more radicalized approach to different ideas or a radicalized approach to, you know, who was speaking for the economically disadvantaged in this country. Have we really come that far?
Not really that far. I often point to that time period because if you look at around the time of Hamilton, papers were brutal towards opposition candidates. And it was really, for 100 years there, it was really tough to be in politics given the way that papers attacked people.
There was disinformation. There were conspiracy theories abroad and both domestically. I mean, it was all there.
It was all there, yeah. And one of the things that I think was dissatisfying for me for the Social Dilemma movie was that at the end of the day, they blame the companies and surveillance capitalism for all of these ill effects in society. And I think that's letting humans off the hook a little bit too easily. We've had these tendencies no matter what media we've been using, and we need to work against those tendencies of misinformation and conspiracy theorizing in really diligent, really wholehearted ways. And it doesn't feel like we're doing that part, the human part. The technology part we can address through regulation and through technological fixes. But I think if we just assume that it's technology making us do bad things, that's never going to really address the problem.
Cliff Lampe is a professor of information at the University of Michigan School of Information. Cliff, I know it's going to be a long rest of the year, so thank you for helping us think about some guidelines for surfing through it.
Thanks so much.